Okay, warm welcome to everyone on a very warm day. I've been saying to Gary Geddes that he has powers to move the weather, and thank you for bringing the summer weather. It gives me great pleasure to welcome and introduce Gary Geddes. I am Miranda Hickman. I'm overseeing the Poetry Matters Initiative with McGill's Department of English. And I want to extend thanks as we begin to the Poetry Matters team, the generosity of the Department of English, the League of Canadian Poets, and the Linda Fernandez Fund for making this event with Gary possible. We have masks available, and in deference to the requests of people attending today, some immunocompromised, we ask that people wear masks, so thank you. And we would like to begin by acknowledging that we are located on unceded Indigenous lands on the traditional territory of the Ginyankahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. The Ginyankahaga are recognized as the custodians of the lands and waters on which we gather today. Jojoba, also called Montreal, is historically known as a gathering place for many First Nations, and today it's home to a diverse population of Indigenous and other peoples. We respect the continued connections with the past, present, and future in our ongoing relationships with Indigenous and other peoples within the community of the Jojoba. Take a few minutes to let people come in. Yes, welcome. Welcome.
There are lots of chairs up here too.
Yeah.
Hi, Gary.
So,
you and your sense of direction, the corner of Sherbrooke and University, right?
Right.
You were only here 18 years. I was here 55.
And I
still get lost.
Well, welcome. So let me step to registering another warm welcome to Gary Geddes and a welcome back. Because Gary comes to us, has traveled to us from British Columbia, where he now lives on Thetis Island, where he grew up in Vancouver. And it's a return to Montreal for Gary because he taught for 2 decades at Concordia University next door in Montreal, where he had much to do with the renewal of the program in creative writing at that time. So welcome back, and thank you for being with us. We're very fortunate that we were one of your destinations for your travels this time, about which perhaps you can say more. So Gary comes to us after a long, extraordinarily acclaimed career over the decades as a prolific poet, anthologist, translator, and nonfiction author. Gary has written and edited more than 50 books of poetry, fiction, drama, criticism, and nonfiction. And he's known for anthologies. Many of you may be familiar with his much-referenced anthology, 20th Century Poetry and Poetics from Oxford, and there are others. Professor Geddes is recognized as one of Canada's finest politically engaged poets, known as a passionate advocate for justice and human rights, who has put his travels and writing where his advocacy is. And today for Poetry Matters, he'll be focusing on his poetry, both older and newer. But I'll also mention the nonfiction books, such as the 2017 Unbundled, A Journey Through the Minefields of Indigenous Healthcare, written out of interviews with and research into the experiences of survivors of residential schools and Canada's segregated hospitals for Indigenous peoples. And I'll mention also Drink the Bitter Root, A Search for Justice and Healing in Africa, which was developed out of Geddes' travel through Africa, puts words to the experiences of victims of violence in countries such as Rwanda, Uganda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Ethiopia. Ian Smillie calls the book a deeply textured journey without maps into the unexplored rifts of sub-Saharan Africa, into the human experience and the psyche. The many national and international awards Gary has received for his work include, but are not limited to, the E.J. Pratt Medal and Prize for Poetry, the Archibald Lampman Award, the Gabriela Mistral Prize from the Government of Chile, and the Commonwealth Poetry Prize. Also, the Freedom to Read Award in recognition of the work Geddes Writing has done to promote free expression. Of the collections that you will be featuring today, of which we have copies available in the back for sale, one is more retrospective, The Ventriloquist, Poetic Narratives from the Womb of War, which gathers and republishes four collections of poetry published in the past, now together through Rocks Mills Press. And the one that is entitled The Oysters I Bring to Banquets presents new poems, often playfully erudite, some of them elegiac, many keyed to specific individuals, some about building a greenhouse. And I'll just mention briefly a few of the new poems that I especially love this fall. One that captures and gets real in stark language about the moment in April 2020 we were all living through, when no one around the globe knew what would unfold from what we were experiencing. One in tribute to the late Evan Boland, called By No Means Gone, and one called Like Housekeeping, with a nod to Marilyn Robinson, whose power of sound stays with me. Downward dip as the rain slips from the bridge trestle into the slick black waters of the lake. And then there's Matins, which with its images and verbs gets to the raw heart of something that we face and deal with every day. This one I'll quote from at some length. He rises early, turns on the radio as water heats up in the tea kettle. He learns of further unmarked graves, discovered at a former residential school, a huge troop buildup at Russia's border with Ukraine, more Saudi airstrikes on rebel forces in Yemen, a million Uyghurs facing involuntary re-education in Xinjiang. And then, as the poem concludes, the water has boiled. As the tea bag bleeds in the brimming blue mug, he can feel the termites gnawing at his timbers. So I come away from the work compelled by what you've said over the years, adapting an idea from Conrad about poetry as a kind of rescue work. Have been very moved by that. Work that gathers the vanishing fragments of memory and gives them the permanence of art, and perhaps it's rescue work of another kind as well. And I was also caught by the tension that you've identified, the kind of tug that you felt as a poet between the impulses of narrative and the impulses of lyric, so story and song. And I hope you'll be able to say a bit more about that today and at the workshop on Friday. Just to let people know, there will be a workshop with Gary on Friday, parallel time, so 3:30 to 5:30, and in the same place. And you're very, very welcome to come if you'd like. So without further ado, let me turn things over to Gary. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Miranda. It's hard to resist being in a place that has something called Poetry Matters. And thank you for the invitation, as well as that introduction, to come and share my reasons for why poetry matters. It's a something that I've been doing now, I guess, I'm 82 years old. I've been writing poems for, I think, at least 60 of those years, and I'm still learning. And one of the great joys of being a creative writing teacher at Concordia was that I was working with young writers all the time, and they were often better than I am, so it was a learning process for me. So, you know, one of the reasons poetry matters for me was very beautifully summed up by John Berger, that famous art critic, a British art critic who moved to France on a farm, and much of his best writing comes from that period as a farmer, getting to know the people working the land. And he said, "Poetry makes language care because it renders everything intimate." He said, "There is nothing more substantial to place against the cruelty and indifference of this world than this caring." And for me, that was such a beautiful comment to discover, because it is that very intimacy of poetry that makes it work. That's one of the important things. So I want to start off sharing with you an experience where I had to depend on that intimacy coming from someone else rather than from my own efforts. Hi, come in and take one of these seats in the front here.
Couldn't get here earlier.
On the 4th of May, 1970, I was standing in front of the U.S. consulate in Toronto protesting the escalation of the Vietnam War into Cambodia. Somebody tapped me on the shoulders and said, "Did you hear what happened in Kent State today?" I hadn't heard. The Ohio National Guard had opened fire on the students, unarmed students at Kent State, sending 211 rounds of assault weapons ammunition into the crowd, killing 4 students and wounding another 9. I felt as if a generation gap the size of the Grand Canyon had opened up between myself and my parents' generation. It was a terrifying moment. It could not tell where things were going to go from there. And I felt this terrible pressure and urgency to write about it. And all I could do, unfortunately, was write diatribes against American foreign policy, which didn't work. I just had to put them all aside. I had a folder full of crap about that experience. Anyway, I was appointed writer in residence at the University of Alberta, and on a cold winter day, I went out along White Avenue, and I found myself going into this little place called the Wee Book Inn, secondhand books. Usually I would have gone to the poetry section, but instead this day I went to the political science section. And a little red paperback caught my attention, and I pulled it out. Price was good, it was $1. And it was called The Killings at Kent State. It was by that absolutely brilliant investigative journalist, I.F. Stone. He was so good that even his enemies read everything that he wrote just to see where the world was standing at a given moment. So I paid the dollar and I went home and I sat down and started to look at this book. And Stone had been trying to figure out why none of the soldiers who shot these students was ever brought to justice. And so in the process of reading it, one of the victims, the description of one of the victims, Sandra Lee Scheuer, just absolutely grabbed me. There were 4 things that I learned about her. She was a speech therapy student. She was very tidy. She liked to roller skate. And she was not the least bit political. Amazingly, I sat down and wrote the poem in a few hours. And was able to chuck all those 6 years of crap into the garbage can. Here's the poem for what it's worth. And what it's worth is owed to I.F. Stone because of the intimacy of the materials he provided. You might have met her on a Saturday night, cutting precise circles clockwise at the Moon Glow roller rink, or walking with quick step between the campus and the green 2-story house, where the room was always tidy, the bed made, the books in confraternity on the shelves. She did not throw stones, major in philosophy, or set fire to buildings, though acquaintances say she hated war, had heard of Cambodia. In truth, she wore a modicum of makeup, a brassiere, and could no doubt more easily have married a guardsman than cursed or put a flower in his rifle barrel. While the armories burned, she studied, bent low over notes, speech therapy books, pages open at sections on impairment, physiology. And while they milled and shouted on the commons, she helped a boy named Billy with his lisp, saying, "Hiss, Billy, like a snake. That's it. Sss. Tongue well up and back behind your teeth. Now buzz, Billy, like a bee. Feel the air vibrating in my windpipe as I breathe." As she walked in sunlight through the parking lot at noon, feeling the world a passing lovely place, a young guardsman who had his sights on her was going down on one knee, as if he might propose. His declaration, unmistakable, flowered within her, passed through her neck, severed her trachea, taking her breath away. Now who will burn the midnight oil for Billy? Ensure the perilous freedom of his speech? And who will see her skating at the Moonglow roller rink, the 8 small wooden wheels making their countless revolutions on the floor? It was certainly great to have that material, that intimate material from I.F. Stone to write that poem. And for me, poetry is both a call to action, and at its best, it's a source of healing. It speaks to the wound in each of us, the part that is in ruins or often broken, and it flies like a plane underneath the radar, and it gets into the body, and somehow it can change our chemistry, and that's the way I feel about it. And I have a little narrative poem that's in this new book. It was something I wrote as a graduate student at the University of Toronto. I'd like to share with you. It takes about 7 minutes. When I, as Miranda said, when I write something, I feel something coming on. I'm torn between two impulses, the impulse to story or narrative and the impulse to lyricism and song. And because these are both really essential to the kind of work that I do, the writing of long poems, I try to marry those two things. Because as T.S. Eliot says, you can't write a good long poem unless you become a master of the prose connective as well. In other words, you've got shifting emotions and levels of intensity through the poem. So I love, I was doing my research for a book about an ancient monk who sailed from China to the Americas in 458 AD. And he had fled Afghanistan. Just hang on a minute, and we get all these folks settled. Do come up and sit down here. There are lots of seats up in the front here. Even a couple of soft ones over there. When I was in Afghanistan on a Taliban visa, the summer of 9/11, I crossed over into China and tried to follow the path of these Buddhist monks that were mentioned in the records of the Liang dynasty of having sailed 20,000 li to the east. And of course, that takes you to Alaska, British Columbia, Washington, California, Mexico, and so on. It was not a popular theory about anthropologists, but it was one that fascinated me because I grew up on the West Coast, and all of these glass bowls, these fishing floats from Japanese fishing boats, ended up on the coast in BC. So why, by accident or by design, would the Chinese or the Asians generally not have discovered America long before Columbus? So anyway, in the process of going from Kabul, where I was really impeded from doing any research about Buddhists because they just trashed the Bamiyan Buddhas in Kabul, I went over the Karakoram Highway in the Himalayas and into western China. And I came across a small town called Dunhuang. And also a village, a city, an Arab village called Gaocheng, which had been covered with sand, and the Chinese were now uncovering that city. And I was on a donkey cart going across that ancient ruined city when another tap on the shoulders, a young Chinese man from Shanghai said to me, "Gary, did you know what happened in New York yesterday?" And I had no idea. Well, this in this ruined city, they'd already constructed an internet cafe, so I spent the next couple of days doing that. But in Dunhuang, in the Buddhist caves, I learned that there was an ancient scholar who had predicted my... He had figured out my predicament a couple of thousand years before I had it. And he had come up with the phrase, narrate as if singing, sing as if narrating. So bringing story and song together in this fabulous way. So if you'll forgive me, I'll read you this little narrative poem. It's about the Spanish conquest. The ships are traveling from Spain to the New World, apparently New World. And they became becalmed in something known as the doldrums, otherwise known as the horse latitudes. And that's because the horses, when there's no wind, the ships run out of water, the horses have to be dumped overboard. So this young man is there, he's the master of horse. He's going slightly out of his mind. He's making a making in his head a letter to his sister back in Spain. So I'll just start to read this for you. Hope that we don't get too much noise. I was signed on the king's authority as master of horse. I remember quite clearly, 3 days after we parted, I did not really believe it. It seemed so much the unrolling of an incredible dream. Bright plumes, scarlet tunics, glint of sunlight on armor. 50 of the king's best horses, strong, high-spirited, rearing to the blast of trumpets, galloping down the long avenida to the waiting ships. And me, your brother, permitted to ride with cavalry. Laughter, children singing in the market, women dancing, throwing flowers, the whole street covered with flowers. In the Plaza del Sol, a blind beggar kissed my eyes. I hadn't expected the softness of his fingers moving upon my face. A bad beginning. The animals knew, hesitated at the ramps, backed off, finally had to be blindfolded and beaten aboard. The sailors grumbled for days as if we had brought on board a cargo of women. But the sea smiled as we lost our escort of gulls, smiled as we passed through the world's gate. I've seen such smiles on the faces of whores in Barcelona. For months now, an unwelcome guest in my own body, I squat by the fire in a silence broken only by the tireless grinding of insects. I've taken to drawing your face in the brown earth at my feet. The ears are never quite right. You're waving, your tears are a river that swells, rushes beside me. I lie for days in a sea drier than the desert of the moors, but your tears are lost, sucked into the parched throat of the sky. I'm watched daily. The ship's carpenter is at work nearby, fashioning a harness within the stockade, fashioning a harness for me, a wooden collar. He is a fool who takes no pride in his work, yet the chips lie about his feet, beautiful as yellow petals. Days melt in the hot sun, flow together. An order is given to jettison the horses. It sweeps like a breeze over parched black faces. I am not consulted, though Ortega comes to me later when it is over and says, God knows there are men I'd have worried less to lose. The sailors are relieved, fall to it with abandon. The first horse is blindfolded, led to the gunwales and struck so hard it leaps skyward in an arc, its great body etched against the sun. I remember thinking how graceless it looked, out of its element, legs braced and stiffened for the plunge. They drink long draughts, muzzles submerged to the eyes, set out like spokes in all directions. The salt does its work. First scream, proud head thrown back, nostrils flared, flesh tight over teeth and gums, yellow teeth, bloody gums, the spasms, heaving bodies, turning, turning. I am the center of this churning circumference, the wretch beside me, fingers knotted to the gunwales. They plunge toward the ship, hooves crashing on the planked hull, soft muzzles ripped and bleeding on splintered wood and barnacles. The ensign's mare struggles half out of the water on the backs of two hapless animals. When the affair ended, the sea was littered with bodies, smooth, bloated carcasses. Neither pike pole nor ship's boats could keep them off. Sailors that never missed a meal retched violently in the hot sun. Only the silent industry of sharks could give them rest. What is the shape of freedom after all? Did I come here to be devoured by insects or maddened by screams in the night? Ortega, when we found him, pinned and swinging in his bones, jawbone pinned and singing in the wind, God's lieutenant, more eloquent in death. Sooner or later, hope evaporates. Joy itself is seasonal. They are Spaniards, no more and no less, and burn with a lust that sends them tilting at the sun itself. Ortega, listen, the horses, where are the sun's horses to pull his chariot from the sea, end this conspiracy of dark? The nights are long, the cold, a maggot boarding in my flesh. I hear them moving, barely perceptible, faint as the roar of insects, gathering to thunder across the hidden valleys of the sea, crash of hooves upon my door, hot, quick breath upon my face. My eyes, he kissed my eyes, the softness of his fingers moving. Forgive me, I did not mean this to be my final offering. Sometimes the need to forgive, be forgiven, makes the heart a pilgrim. I'm no traveler, my Christopher, faced with rubbing on the voyage out, the voyage into exile. Islanded in our separate selves, words are too frail a bridge. I see you in the morning, running to meet me down the mountainside, your face transfigured with happiness. Wait for me, my sister, where wind rubs bare the cliff face, where we rode to watch the passing ships at daybreak and saw them burn golden from masthead down to waterline. I will come soon. I think I owe a lot to Ezra Pound and his translations from the Chinese for that poem. I certainly had a lot of Pound's rhythm, not his imagery, but his rhythms in my head when I wrote that. So poetry is not only special to me. It doesn't just matter to me because of the specificity of things and speaking through to the senses the way it does. Poetry is a primary process language. It's the language we first hear, probably the heartbeat in the womb, the mother's heartbeat in the womb. Repeated, the infant sucks every syllable and letter and repeats what the mother and others are saying, sometimes ad nausea, but it all has a purpose because it's reconstructing a bridge of words that connects it to the mother and to the rest of us. And the child has no concern about logic or reason. Their sound is definitely privileged over sense in the child's, in that primal language I'm talking about. And the child has no difficulty imagining a cow jumping over the moon or the dish running away for a clandestine weekend in Toronto with a spoon. So there's something really profound about that that stays with us for a lifetime, I think. When we are experiencing extremes of grief or pain or joy even, we don't go looking for an essay, and we probably won't even go looking for a novel. But sometimes we'll find ourselves looking for a poem, because it takes us back to that rich primal language of the heart. So I have this new book, The Ventriloquist. It happened very peculiarly. My friend David Stover was president of Oxford University Press, and I had done some anthology work for them over the years, and when he retired, he started a small literary press called Rocks Mills Press in Oakville. And I had directed some friends to him, and he ended up publishing their work. One of them is right here, Lewis. So it was such a surprise to me when he emailed me one day and said, "Gary, if you've got anything out of print, I'll be glad to bring it back into print." How often does that happen? Not very often. So rather than exploit David's generous offer and give him four books of poems to publish, I said, let's put all of these into one book. And he was happy to do that. It's called The Ventriloquist Poetic Narratives from the Womb of War. And it's not, it's been described as anti-war poems. I never thought of them as anti-war poems. I just simply thought of them as poems about the ravages of conquest and war. And you have to get down and dirty if you want to be able to tell those stories. One of the stories in here is about the Terracotta Army and the Chinese pottery figures in Xi'an. I think I was the first poet ever to write about those figures in an extended form, poetic form. And another is about the mad bomber of the House of Commons, Paul Joseph Chartier, who died when a bomb he was carrying exploded in the men's washroom in Ottawa. So these strange things happen to me. It's explained by the word ventriloquist. A graduate student of mine in Western Washington University came to me one day and she said, "I just found this incredible book called The Ventriloquism of History." And the phrase just stayed with me, because that's the experience that I have had as a writer so often. It's as though the world is full of disembodied voices, silenced by turmoil or time, who are just traveling the ether looking for a sucker like me to tell their story. And when they do, they take me by the throat and won't let go until I tell the story. It has a downside, of course, because I'm never sure if I'm the ventriloquist or the dummy. But I'm going to read you a couple of pieces from a sequence called Hong Kong Poems. The Canadian government cynically sent Seaforce to Hong Kong. The Second World War was well underway in the fall of 1941. There'd been nobody, all the Canadian soldiers were still sitting in the mud in England. They hadn't seen any action. When Mackenzie King went over to England to cheer up the troops, they booed him. And so Canada needed blood quickly to encourage the recruitment of soldiers. So they sent 1,975 Canadian soldiers from the Winnipeg Grenadiers and the Royal Rifles of Canada from Quebec City to Hong Kong via Vancouver. They were there for about 17 days, and then Pearl Harbor happened, and the next day the Japanese invaded Hong Kong. And the Canadians fought bravely, but there was no way they could stand crack Japanese troops who'd been training in China and so on. They lasted for quite a few days and surrendered on Christmas Day in 1941. Not exactly the way they had expected to celebrate that event. Those who survived were in Japanese and Hong Kong, Japanese prisoner of war camps in Hong Kong and Japan. They were slave labor, basically, and many more died there. They came back, and they had to fight with the Canadian government for 25 years to get any attention for what they'd gone through and for full acknowledgement. So my friend Douglas Elias from the Museum of Man and Nature came to visit me in Victoria, his annual pilgrimage. And he came like the Ancient Mariner to dump one albatross off his back onto mine. And it was a story of the fall of Hong Kong. And I just couldn't get over the details that he gave me. It was another one of those, many of those voices from the past. And here are a couple of figures from that sequence called Hong Kong Poems. This is the voice of Henderson. I did most of my fighting in Repulse Bay in a hotel half full of civilians. We took up position in a plush suite on the second floor. One of the men sat in an armchair, scanning hills out back with binoculars. When he spotted movements, I'd swing into the window and fire, then drop back. Suddenly there was a woman in the doorway saying, "My dog! I'm looking for water for my dog!" We pulled her down out of the line of fire and gave the dog radiator water we used for tea. Later, when the Japanese were 2 football fields away and their planes were dive-bombing the barracks, I thought of that woman and her parting comment, "If he bothers you by barking, shoot him." Stiff upper lip of the Brits. This is the last moment at the, in the fall of Hong Kong. It's called, the speaker is Sullivan. There's a strange hush at St. Stephen's as we wait for them to storm the college. Nurses drift like butterflies among the injured, offering a word, a touch, a cigarette. When the enemy bursts through the door, I'm lying on a cot at the far end of the corridor, my head bandaged, my legs supported in a sling. 2 soldiers proceed to bayonet the sick and wounded in their beds to a chorus of screams and protests. A nurse throws herself on top of one of our boys to protect him. It might have been the kid from Queens, and they are both killed by a single thrust of the bayonet. I suppose they were sweethearts. Pinned at last, she does not struggle. Her hands open and close once like tiny wings, and the dark stain on her white starched uniform spreads like a chrysanthemum, a blood-red sun. I cut the cord supporting my legs, slip on the nearest smock, and stand foolishly at attention, making the salute. My right index finger brushes the damp cotton of the bandage. Later, the butchers are shot by their own officers. One, apparently, had lost a brother in the final assault. Well, thank you. Thank you for that.